Good afternoon, everybody. This is WWTC, Minneapolis, St. Paul. My name is Arnie Fogel. John Lennon. The name itself is enough to bring about an instant flash of memories of a lifetime. Not just his lifetime, talking about your lifetime. Sitting as a kid in front of the TV screen during an early Ed Sullivan show, or an even earlier Jack Parr program. The memories of the radio stations as they would tease you by playing a choice cut, or two, from the latest Beatle album, 2 or 3 days before it was available. And later on, when you first began to study him and his three partners, the revelation that they weren't newborn the first time you saw them with Sullivan, but that they had a history. Long nights playing for next to nothing in the dingy cellars of Liverpool and Hamburg, Germany. You learn that the voice of John Lennon was first recorded in 1961, and the first Lennon composition to be recorded was an instrumental, also from 1961, called Cry for a Shadow. Ain't She Sweet, Cry for a Shadow. It was all nearly 20 years ago. No need to go into a long rehash of the recent facts. Suffice to say that John Lennon, age 40, is dead, cut down by an assassin's bullets during the flush of success of his first album in almost 6 years. It's a tremendously sad time for those of us who treasured his work and career, and for those like myself, who literally idolized the man and all he stood for. But John was a brilliant man, a witty man, and the most important popular musician of the last 35 years. And in compiling this celebration of his life, I'm happy to report that I've been studying him, laughing a little, and listening a lot.
We didn't break up because we weren't friends. We just broke up out of sheer boredom, you know.
Merry Christmas, everybody!
Christmas cheer from John, Paul, George, and Ringo, 1963. A tribute to John Lennon today on WWTC. I'm not alone in the studio. I have a person who not only is very deeply mourning the loss of John Lennon, as are many of us, but she's been doing a very special service to Beatle fans, for Beatle fans, for a number of years now. Her name is Barb Fenwick. How are you, Barb?
Okay.
Barb Fenwick is going to be sitting here with me. Possibly you may want to call her a little later on today if you want to talk with her. She'll be sitting in for the rest of the time we're here. We'll be here till 4 o'clock, and we'll be doing another John Lennon tribute tomorrow from 2 till 4. Once again, my name is Arnie Fogel. His name is John Lennon.
And it tends to get into a format, you know? Because we were together much longer than the public knew us.
And now a demonstration of the voice that over the last 20 years has often been described as one of the greatest rock and roll voices in the history of the music. Angular, lean, passionate, and infinitely emotive. Here's John Lennon interpreting the classic rock and roll of composers other than himself.
Hey, oh yes, wait a minute, Mr.
John Lennon was born October 9th, 1940. By the time he was a teenager, his mother was dead and his father gone. But it was when he turned 16 that John Lennon's life and all of rock music changed when he first met Paul McCartney. They'd been playing in different bands one night at a small church in Liverpool. They soon struck up a friendship, and before long, a band, with the addition of Paul's school friend, George Harrison. At first, the band was called the Moondogs, then the Moonshiners, the Silver Beatles, and finally, just the Beatles. Teamed up with drummer Pete Best, later replaced by Ringo Starr, and guitarist Stuart Sutcliffe, who later died, they traveled to Hamburg, Germany in 1960 and played their first relatively high-paying job for $25 a week. Then it was back to Liverpool and performances at the famed Cavern Club, where they were discovered by a young man whose father ran a TV and record shop. His name was Brian Epstein, and as their manager became the real guiding force for the band until his death in 1967. Epstein persuaded the boys to clean up their act, to change their leather jackets for suits and distinctive haircuts. Then, in October 1962, their first recording contract with Parlophone Records.
Love me,
the song was was produced by staff producer George Martin, a man who went on to mold the sound of the Beatles for more than a decade through a string of hit singles. Please Please Me, From Me to You, She Loves You, and I Want to Hold Your Hand. One of the men that knew the Beatles best in those days was their music publisher, Dick James.
John always had an incredible sense of humor. It was cynical. He was outwardly very cynical. Inside, he was a very sincere and very sensitive, creative person. Unique, I think, is the word, because I met with John and with Paul, and they always complimented each other with their comparables.
I grew hearing all the songs he ever sang with the Beatles and after Alone, and he was a very important person for me.
Some have said the Beatles' music remained popular after the group's 1970 breakup because its message crossed what was then called the generation gap. And evidence of that was seen in Los Angeles, in a high school there the other day after Lennon's death, when students were allowed to stand and say what they felt.
And a lot of people who don't even know what John Lennon stood for are going to be calling him a martyr and going to be sympathizing with Yoko when they don't even understand why he lived or what he stood for.
I was completely in shock. And now I wonder why I was in shock. I wasn't alive. I don't remember the Beatles' music when they first came out. I've listened to their records, and I think that the Beatles, perhaps their music, was the greatest of all time.
I think we'll all pull out of it. Still, I feel a loss.
There was also a five-week tour. In 1964 came John Lennon's first book, In His Own Right, and the Beatles' first movie, A Hard Day's Night. 1965 brought another album and another movie, Help, plus the famed concert at New York's Shea Stadium, one of the biggest rock concerts of all time, conceived and promoted by Sid Bernstein, who also remembers John Lennon.
He talked about kids, and I watched as he had kids of his own and grew with them and was close to them. He was an incredible father. He gave of his time, and it's a lesson to all of us that our children are precious and they need our time. And his kids are going to miss him terribly, and so is the rest of the world.
And it was during this time that Lennon's caring and concern turned outward, that he began using his power and influence to affect social change. Richard Lester was directing the shooting of the film Help and remembers one such incident.
We were shooting in Nassau on Help, and we had been shooting in the remains of a mental home, which was an absolute disgrace. And that evening, we were invited by the governor of Nassau to come to a formal dinner, and everyone was in evening dress. And John took that opportunity to publicly attack the government and its attitude about allowing this kind of decay and to treat human beings the way they did. And it's a memory I think that I will always remember John doing.
But John was also the court jester of the Beatles, a real jokester trying to find humor in much of anything. In one of his final interviews before his death, Lennon spoke with a BBC reporter about those happier times.
Looking back, you know, because we tried to do it with humor, it was really irrelevant sort of serious critics in the pop business said about what we were doing in bed and bags and that, as long as our what we felt our duty or our position was to keep on about peace until something happened, you know. And we, it was in the tradition of Gandhi, only with a sense of humor.
Ironically, one of Lennon's earliest personal commitments to the peace movement was his first serious acting role in a film called How I Won the War. The year was 1967, and for the first time in many years, the Beatles did not tour, working instead in the studios, recording an album that many say was the high point of their careers, Sgt. Pepper's. The album had sold a million copies before it was even released. But already, John had thoughts of breaking up the band.
Well, it wasn't that I wanted to tour so much, but I didn't know what to do. What the hell do you do all day, you know? I mean, so I did the movie, which was boring as hell, and 6 weeks there. But I was really too scared to walk away. I was thinking, well, this is like the end, really. You know, there's no more touring. that means there's going to be a blank space in the future at some time or other. That's when I really started considering, what can one do? Considering the life without the Beatles, what would it be? And I spent that 6 weeks thinking about that. What am I going to do, you know? Am I going to be doing Vegas, I call it now, but cabaret? I mean, where do you go, you know? So that's when I started thinking about it, but I could not think what it would be or how I could do it, or I didn't consider forming my own group or anything because it didn't even enter my mind. Just what would I do when it stopped?
In John's personal life, it was a time for change. His first wife, Cynthia, filed for divorce on grounds of adultery, charging that John was as good as married to another woman, Yoko Ono. A month before the divorce was finalized, Yoko announced the birth of Lennon's second child. In 1968, a new record company for the Beatles, Apple. Its first release was to become another classic, Hey Jude. By now, rumors that the Beatles were breaking up were rampant. John and Yoko were touring on their own, carrying their Give Peace a Chance message to the entire world. In March, they took time out to get married, but not without some trouble. In 1968, a double record set was released simply entitled The Beatles, but better known as The White Album. The fall of 1969, the Beatles released their last complete work as a group, Abbey Road. And with the turn of the decade, the Beatles were as good as gone. Ringo was pursuing a solo musical and acting career. George also going solo, following the lead of Paul McCartney. And for John Lennon and wife Yoko Ono, new adventures in the world of avant-garde art. Many felt that the breakup of the Beatles was because of a rivalry between John and Paul.
Rivalry between two guys, you know, I mean, it was always there. It was a creative rivalry. Like there was a rivalry between the Beatles and the Stones. It was a creative rivalry. In that respect, it was not a terrible, vicious, horrible vendetta. I used my resentment against Paul that I have as a kind of sibling rivalry resentment from youth to create a song.
But the team and the dream were gone. The energies dispersed in separate directions. There followed for John Lennon a series of hit singles and albums, Instant Karma, Imagine, Happy Christmas, and others. But his musical energies were distracted by personal problems, by a lengthy legal fight to stay in the United States, despite deportation efforts pegged to a 1968 drug arrest. Lennon won that case, thanks to Yoko's support.
The great woman behind every idiot. And she's the one, and she kept me together. You know, I would have fallen apart a long time ago. And she pulled me through it, and here I am. I thank her, and God bless her.
Life with Yoko had its ups and downs. In October of 1973, Lennon went out to buy a newspaper and never came back. Instead, he flew off to Los Angeles to begin a drinking and drug-taking binge to rival any man's midlife crisis. But by early 1975, John was reunited with Yoko, and their relationship was stronger than ever before.
I don't believe in Beatles. Just believe in me. Yoko and me.
Between 1975 and 1980, John Lennon did not record, instead turning his and Yoko's life inward, taking special pride in their son, Sean. Even John admits that those 5 years, he was out of touch.
We were having a fine, fine old time. It's just that we were making no comment. When Elvis died, people were harassing me in Tokyo for a comment. Well, I'll give it you now, he died when he went in the army. Mm. You know, that's when they killed him. That's when they castrated him. So the rest of it was just a living death.
Eventually, John and Yoko settled on New York City as their new home, buying into the exclusive, high-security Dakota Apartments, seeking anonymity in the concrete canyons of the Big Apple.
That's what made me finally stay here. It wasn't a conscious decision. I just found that I was going to movies, going to restaurants, and I have the 5 years, you think, you know, it was just bacon, bed, and the baby. No, when I left England, I still couldn't go on the street. It was still Carnaby Street and all that stuff was going on. We couldn't walk around the block, couldn't go to a restaurant, unless you wanted to go with the business of the star going to the restaurant garbage. I've even been walking the streets for the last 7 years.
One of the men who knows most about this period of Lennon's life is writer Lawrence Shames.
One of the things that characterized him and Yoko both was a real love-hate for the city and a love-hate for the whole idea of being that well-known and being recognized. And I think that although Lennon genuinely did want his privacy, I think that to really go somewhere where he would be obscure and unknown, maybe he just couldn't quite make that break.
During this five-year period, Lennon turned his attention to personal finances, buying lands, buying expensive mansions, even buying prize-winning cattle, hobnobbing with the jet set, sailing in Palm Beach, and in 1980, surprising the music world with a new album, sounding a bit self-conscious about his 5 years in hiding.
People say I'm crazy.
Just days before his death, that John and Yoko recorded their annual Christmas message to the world.
Happy Christmas.
And so this is Christmas. And what have you done? Another year over. Et cetera, et cetera. Nice to be here. Hi.
You both look very well, and I think I'm right in saying you're both very happy.
We're pretty damn steady, I'd say. That. We're in good condition. Thank you very much. It's great to talk to you. And it's not kindness. We want to sell the record, and we want to talk to the English, too.
It's a pleasure. Happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas.
And a brobrach mullach neck the new.
Monday, December 8th, New Yorkers celebrated the Christmas season with the traditional tree lighting ceremony in Rockefeller Plaza. It was a warm evening, temperature in the low 60s. With the story of John Lennon's last night, here's C.D. Jaco.
John Lennon and Yoko Ono left their apartment in New York's famous Dakota Apartment building Monday afternoon, headed for the Record Plant, a local studio. They were preparing to cut a new single. They may not have noticed a young man standing on the street. Neighbors say he'd been hanging around the Dakota for several days. Only hours before, he had asked John for an autograph on an album. Lennon signed it. About 10:30 at night, John and Yoko returned from the studio. They stepped out of their limousine and started inside. The young man who'd been hanging around called to them. John turned. The young man was in a military firing position, both hands around the grip of a Charter Arms 38 caliber revolver, his knees bent. He emptied the gun into Lennon. Lennon staggered several feet and collapsed in an office area.
What happened? I saw John and Yoko get out of the limousine. They walked into the gate and, oh God,
Why don't you take your time?
And then I heard four or five shots. They were ear shattering. I heard Yoko, and I heard a woman screaming. It was Yoko. She was screaming, help me.
Police cars raced to the Dakota, where officers found Lennon and lifted him into the back seat.
Three cop cars and about five people counting me, and I saw the cops wrestling with a guy in a tan jacket and tinted glasses and kind of a brownish blonde haircut, heavy set, and they threw the cuffs on him and put him into a police car. And moments after that, I saw four officers carrying John Lennon out, and he was bleeding in the mouth, and he looked very unconscious, and they put him into the back of the police car and they took him to the hospital.
The squad car was driven at top speed to the emergency room of Roosevelt Hospital, about a mile away. Dr. Stephen Lynn is in charge of that emergency room.
John Lennon was brought to the emergency room of the Roosevelt site, St. Luke's Roosevelt Hospital, this evening, shortly before 11 p.m. He was dead on arrival.
Dr. Lynn broke the news to Yoko.
I did tell his wife that he was dead, and she was most distraught at the time and found it quite hard to accept.
Outside the Dakota, hundreds of people, shocked and stunned, gathered in the warm New York night. Local radio stations played nothing but Beatles songs. The faithful lit candles, wept in each other's arms, laid flowers on the building grillwork, and cried for John Lennon and for that part of our youth that had died.
I heard Imagine, and I started to cry, and then I called my sister, and she started to cry, and it was horrible.
Like, to a lot of people, something like this, you know, to millions of people, this has the impact of a presidential assassination. There's no question about it.
It's the first thing that went through my mind. Like, this is, for me, it's like John Kennedy, because I remember I was like 7 at the time or something, and I remember my parents crying and stuff like that. And this is the first time this kind of impact has occurred on me. I don't know. I can't imagine the world without him. I really can't.
And amid the sorrow, confusion. Who shot John Lennon? Why? The young man who'd been hanging around for a week just stood there after firing, threw the gun down, and was grabbed by a doorman. He was taken to 20th Precinct headquarters nearby.
We have arrested Mark David Chapman of 55 South Kukui, K-U-K-U-I Street, Hawaii, for the homicide of John Lennon.
Mark David Chapman, another three names straight off the police blotter. Names like Lee Harvey Oswald, like James Earl Ray. Mark David Chapman is charged with second-degree murder in the killing of John Lennon. Mark David Chapman is a 25-year-old who traveled from Honolulu to New York City last week with a .38-caliber snub-nosed revolver. He's at Bellevue Psychiatric Hospital in New York City right now. He won't be back to court until January 6th. That's because the judge says Chapman needs to undergo psychiatric tests. Who is Mark David Chapman? He's 25, 5 feet 11, 190 pounds, brown hair, blue eyes. He'd been living in Hawaii for several years, and before that had lived in Texas and Georgia. He'd worked as a security guard and a printer in Hawaii. He graduated from Columbia High School near Atlanta in 1973, and Lucy Badgett was a classmate.
Met him in eighth grade. He was real, very straight. I mean, you know, he's very into schoolwork and everything, and, you know, just real straight. And then he just changed over the years. I mean, I know he played in a band, a local band. Senior year, he was more into religion and everything.
Last week, Chapman supposedly borrowed $2,000 from a friend to fly to New York. Robert Connell is the superintendent of Chapman's Honolulu apartment building.
I didn't even know he was gone. In fact, I just saw him here last week out in front of the condominium, and did not speak to him at the time, but I saw him out there, and I just couldn't believe that he was in New York for this. So it was probably one of the spur-of-the-moment deals that he went into New York for. What purpose, God only knows.
Mark David Chapman allegedly gunned down Lennon with that snub-nosed revolver that he bought October 27th in Honolulu. It was legally registered at the police station down the street from the gun shop. Richard Lester, who directed Lennon in A Hard Day's Night.
It seems appalling to me that all this time nobody has spoken about the problems of people having guns in America and the problems that people can shoot a man on the street and how many more public figures will be killed before some sensible gun control will be passed.
But the gun Chapman supposedly used was registered. He was able to register it, Hawaii police say, because he had no known narcotics record in Hawaii and because he had no known felony record anywhere in the country. So now Mark David Chapman is being looked at by psychiatrists and John Lennon is dead.
The reaction to word of Lennon's murder was quick. With that story, Bob Madigan.
Almost as soon as the news of Lennon's death hit the air, people began to flock to the Dakota. It was too late to help, they knew that. But the vigil was sincere. Signs went up almost immediately, telling Yoko Ono she was not alone in her grief. Flowers began to arrive before dawn. Photos of John were tacked to the iron gates. Gates closed to keep the milling mourners out of the luxury apartment building's courtyard. Through the night, the crowd grew, but remained quiet, talking among themselves in hushed tones. But every so often, the emotions would become so intense, the crowd would break into song. Thousands gathered at the Dakota. Everyone appeared bewildered. They couldn't believe the news. and many seemed to be looking for spiritual answers to what happened. That's why they were drawn to the fashionable address opposite Central Park.
I heard Imagine, and I started to cry, and then I called my sister, and she started to cry, and it was horrible.
Like to a lot of people, something like this, you know, to millions of people, this has the impact of a presidential assassination. There's no question about it.
That was the first thing that went through my mind. Like, this is, for me, it's like John Kennedy, because I remember I was like 7 at the time or something, and I remember my parents crying and stuff like that. And this is the first time this kind of impact has occurred on me. I don't know. I can't imagine the world without him. I really can't.
That feeling was shared by many others. Steve Serkia.
I guess I owe the man something. He's done a lot for me all these years. And I don't know. I was in kindergarten when John Kennedy got shot. And this day just keeps reminding me of the day Kennedy got shot. In fact, the impact is even twice as bad.
The main reason people gravitated to the Lennons' home was because they didn't know what else to do. They'd lost a friend, someone they had known intimately, though never met. Michael Allerman was one who stood in the rain.
All I ever wanted to do was to meet him once. An autograph was secondary, but just to say thanks, because I felt I owed it to him. And some guy just robbed me of my opportunity. And it's just an awful, awful thing. And I mean, I wish I could say something to Yoko. I mean, but no chance. I feel so bad for her.
Some of the people came from far away. Richard Parkins was at home in Ohio when he heard Lennon had been shot. He headed to the Toledo airport, flew to New York City, and took a cab to the Dakota to be part of the vigil.
I'm 31 years old, and you know, I've grown up with the Beatles since I was like 8th grade freshman year of high school, all through college, and you know, their life is part of mine. And so, well, I had the opportunity, I figured I ought to come.
What were you doing when you heard?
I guess I just turned on the TV, getting dressed, and all of a sudden I heard about it, and I was pretty shocked. It's like a little bit of your life has been taken away from you.
Andrew Gelfman felt the same.
I just sat there for like an hour, just listened to the Beatles music, and it's just like, I didn't understand why anyone would want to do something, you know, just go out and kill someone just because they're famous or something.
And the neighbors were shocked. Joe Plava lives but a stone's throw from the Lennons' apartment.
You know, from 5 years, I've seen John and Yoko around a lot of times. Very, very nice people. Always nod, always wave, always something. And just blows me away.
John Lennon was always a man of peace and love, perhaps even for the man who took his life. In 1969, John was asked what he thought of capital punishment.
I can understand people thinking it's the only way to deal with them, because I understand those people. I don't think they're right, because it doesn't help murderers to hang them or help violent people to be violent to them. It is all they understand, but it doesn't. I don't believe violence begets violence, you know.
Hours after his death, John's widow and son released a statement to the press and his many fans. Yoko and Sean said there'd be no funeral for John, just time set aside for a silent vigil to pray for his soul. John loved and prayed for the human race, they said. Please pray the same for him. John Lennon died December 8th, 1980, and with him died a little bit of each of us.
And in the end, the love you take is equal to the love.
Good afternoon. It's about 5 minutes after 2 o'clock and 22 degrees in Minneapolis and St. Paul. This just in. Thousands of people, many bearing flowers and candles in their hands and tears in their eyes, gathered today in New York Central Park for a last farewell to slain Beatle John Lennon. Millions more around the world joined the observance. Some attended local memorial services like the one in New York. Others simply paused for a few moments as hundreds of radio stations joined in a vigil of silence and quiet music. Lennon's widow, Yoko Ono, asked that the world pray for John's soul for 10 minutes, which started at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That was 1 hour ago, Minneapolis time. Police originally estimated as many as 500,000 people would attend the gathering in Central Park, but freezing temperatures and biting winds apparently kept away all but the faithful. For 10 minutes, not a whisper or a word was heard in the heart of New York, the adopted home of a man who helped shape the thinking, singing, and living of an entire generation.